Welcome to Richer Life Insights. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. So today we're having a conversation with Peter Sims. Peter Sims wrote a book that I loved. It's called Little Bets: How Breakthrough Ideas Emerge from Small Discoveries. Peter, thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your insight with us.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
Okay, so I guess maybe I should start with a confession. And my confession is that if there's anybody out there that needs the information in this book, it was me. And it's because I'm the kind of guy, when I get an idea, an hour later, I've already gone IPO with it, right? I've already taken it from conception to sale. I've come up with all these great things that everything that this company is going to do. Yet, I haven't tested anything. And so Sometimes that works out well, but a lot of times it doesn't. And so the compelling message in your book is that you talk about these little bets. Rather than committing everything, you talk about committing small little things and seeing what happens. So maybe you can talk about what is a little bet.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, I think what your approach is similar to the way I approach any type of idea process in the past as well. I mean, it's sort of how we're conditioned to think that we have to have a big idea. But in reality, if you look at how great companies are built, such as Google or Starbucks or Twitter, I mean, they all start very small. Google began as a library search project where Larry Page and Sergey Brin were trying to understand how to prioritize library searches. And they were able to figure out through that set of experiments what could solve an interesting problem for library search that they could apply to more broad information search algorithms. And Starbucks began not with this, finished idea, but when Howard Schultz had the inspiration to create a new type of coffee experience in the U.S., he got a lot of insight from Italy and brought that to the U.S. And the first Starbucks had, you know, nonstop opera music playing. The menus were in Italian and there were no chairs. So he had to make, as he says, you know, a lot of mistakes to figure out what was going to ultimately create the Starbucks experience that we know and become accustomed to. And so, you know, it's a lot of these small experiments, little bets, are really small, affordable ways of discovering ideas and then developing them. So, you know, another example I use often is when you see a comedian like Chris Rock on HBO, he's flawless, but to get there, he spent 6 months to a year trying lots and lots of small ideas in small clubs to see what's going to work and what's not so that he can come up with a cool joke that may have five parts that he can then weave into an act that has, you know, 12, 15, 20 jokes that, you know, over an hour seem perfect when we see it, but it's only through this iterative process of trying and learning from each small step. And there are ways you can do this to be very strategic, and that's really what the book is about. It's how different people who do this well, who make little bets well, actually think and work to dispel the myths.
And so what do you think the advantage in placing these little bets is? Because I'm sure some people are listening or reading and saying, well, you know, I really like to think big, because we're always taught, well, you got to think big, and this is kind of a different approach. So what is the advantage of making a small bet versus a really big bet?
Well, everybody likes to think big, and that is a Silicon Valley mantra. I used to be in venture capital, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book is because people always used to say, oh, I need a big idea before starting a company. But in reality, you know, Twitter got started because Jack Dorsey thought he could come up with short messaging technology that people would like. But he wasn't sure he was solving the right problem until he went through this process of discovery. So he took, you know, several years to figure out what might work with his friends before he even tried to come up with an idea inside the company he was working in. And so even there, it took him 2 weeks to convince enough people that he was solving an interesting problem so that he could get another 6 months to work on the project. And then after 6 months, people inside this company, Odeo, which was a podcasting company, thought it was a pretty interesting idea, an interesting problem he was tackling. So, you know, the company was allowed to, well, the idea was allowed to kind of take on a life of its own. But you really need to use little bets, I think, to discover if you're solving the right problems, if you really tapped into to opportunities that, you know, if it's a Chris Rock joke, is going to work with a small audience before you bet big on going in front of a larger audience. And not even Chris Rock or Jack Dorsey or people we see as very creative and innovative know if they've really come up with an idea that's solving the right problems for other people until they've made a lot of little bets.
And so did you make little bets when you were writing this book?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I thought that it was a problem that everybody needed a big idea before doing something new. But to figure out what I should actually be writing about, I scribbled ideas down on sheets of paper that I bounced off my friends and my family, and through that process ended up talking with somebody who was a former senior executive at Hewlett-Packard, Ned Barnholm, who said, yeah, I really like the way you're thinking here. It reminds me of when I made a lot of mistakes at Hewlett-Packard, when we made big bets on ideas that weren't actually solving problems for users, and we really weren't understanding the needs and the underlying customer dynamics beneath the surface, what we couldn't see through analysis. And so it became clear to me that, you know, through that process of literally prototyping ideas for this book, not only was this little bets concept something that everybody seemed to really like, whether it was entrepreneurs or people who were creatives or people who were in the publishing world, but it was solving a problem that our education system wasn't addressing. And that is we were trained from a young age to analyze and have very linear approaches to solving problems, to try to predict something before we actually take steps out into the world to do it. And so this book is really an attempt to reframe that discussion. You do things to discover what to do in this world where there's so much rapid change. And fortunately, it's tapped a real vein with people who have that problem. But it only came about through a lot of experimentation and iteration and literally using the methods that I describe in the book to do it in a strategic way.
And you talk, one of the chapters is the genius of play. And you talk about how some great ideas and some great, really great discoveries almost by accident can occur when you're quote-unquote playing, when you're conceptualizing, when you're thinking of an idea and things like that. Can you talk about what that genius of play really is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work with a research team at Stanford for this book, and one of the things that we noticed early on in the research is that we interviewed over 200 people who were creative or innovative people, entrepreneurs or people who work at Pixar doing filmmaking or the architect Frank Gehry, or military counterinsurgency strategists, you name it. One of the things we noticed is that across all those groups, they had certain similarities in the methods they used. And one of those was that they used little bets. And then another was that when they were at the early stages of developing their ideas, they were very willing to be playful and even use a lot of humor. And musicians as well. We interviewed John Legend, the recording artist. And they all said the same thing. You can't overanalyze new ideas too early. You can't judge them too early. So at Pixar, for example, they have with an environment that they call a plussing environment where they use techniques out of improvisational comedy to develop their early stage ideas. So if you were to say to me, Peter, I have an idea for a new podcast, I would say, instead of saying, yes, but Robert, you probably shouldn't do a new podcast because you've already got one, I would say, yes, and you've got a great platform to build from, and then go from there. So they use these principles of yes and, taking every offer that somebody gives them, any idea that somebody presents to another person at Pixar is taken, and instead of judged or criticized, it's built upon using these principles, again, from improv, yes and. They call it plussing. And it really is a remarkable part of the Pixar culture. And this is something that, if you look at the research in neuroscience, is shown to actually help the idea generation process. When people are able to be in an improvised state, the neuroscience shows that the part of their brain that is responsible for judging or for censoring their ideas is actually deactivated. So they're no longer judging their own ideas, and they're no longer judging the ideas of the others too prematurely, and instead it opens up this part of the brain which is much more creative. So there's a whole chapter in the book on that. That's just an example of one of the methods that people across all these different areas tend to use.
And, you're talking about improv. Way, 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 way back when I did some improv classes. And that is the first rule of improvisational comedy, is that you never disagree. You never make a judgment. It's always yes, and we should also do this. And so by doing that, it's really freeing when you know that no matter what you say, no matter what you come up with, it's going to be legitimized and it's not going to be criticized. And so that and this also reminds me of Dr. Csikszentmihalyi. It's that psychologist with the name no one can ever pronounce or spell correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
And his whole concept of flow, of this state, right, of just, you know, where you're in the zone. And that's you know, usually happens when you're in an environment where it's not just play, but it's also it's sort of a work environment where your energies and your resources are almost tapped, but not totally, because then it's just frustration.
We all have to work in an environment where we ultimately judge our ideas. So I'm not in any way disputing that you have to be very rigorous, and that's where the testing comes in. That's where Chris Rock is constantly testing his ideas to make sure he's onto the right material and very, very rigorously coming up with something that's perfect. But at the early stages of Chris Rock developing his ideas, he would also use a lot of improvisational techniques and he'll riff with the audience. And I think that's just an area where most of us don't have our muscles very well developed. You know, we don't learn how to do improvised comedy unless, like you've taken a class. We don't learn those types of approaches when we're in school. And so what happens is we tend to be in office environments where we look to what the people at Google call the HIPPO, the highest paid person in the room, for their opinion when we're making decisions about new ideas, when in reality, you know, one of the most proven and effective approaches to developing new ideas is through these improvisational techniques. So it's something that any of us can kind of use if you think of it in terms of like where you might do brainstorming, you know, using improv techniques can actually be, I think, much more effective than just traditional brainstorming techniques.
And so what do you mean by problems are the new solutions?
Well, you know, again, in our educational system, I went through, you know, business school and learn traditional management thinking, we're taught to think in terms of solutions. Now, you know, what form that takes can vary depending on your role, but, you know, think of it as a spreadsheet. You want to look in a spreadsheet in traditional management thinking to be able to predict if you take steps A, B, and C, where you're going to end up. Step C, you want predictability, you want control, you want a solution defined up front. Okay, now, the reality is that's not how the world works. You know, when you're doing something new or uncertain, which is what this book is all about, you know, you need to be able to, before coming up with a solution, make sure you're solving the right problem. And so one of the people I wrote about in that chapter is Muhammad Yunus, who founded the Grameen Bank. And the Grameen Bank is now, you know, the leading micro lender in the world. And you know, here's a guy, Muhammad Yunus, who founded the bank, who was a trained economist. And so he was used to looking at theory and spreadsheets to come up with solutions to big problems. And what he realized is that that wasn't solving the problem of poverty in Bangladesh or India. And so what he did is he went out into the world. He went out into a small town that was nearby where he was teaching for a year, year and a half, and literally tried thousands of little bets to see what he could do to improve things like crop yields, to just improve the farming yields of communities. And what he found through that process as he continued to get closer and closer to the underlying problems is that what was really affecting people the most, especially women, is that they were having to borrow money at exorbitant rates in order to buy inputs for the products they were making, like baskets. They would buy, you know, inputs for baskets such as bamboo that was just so expensive they couldn't get themselves out of a hole by the time they sold it on the other end. And so they were constantly in this cycle of basically enslavement. And so what Yunus did is he said, well, this seems to be the core problem, and it can be solved by lending these people very small amounts of money at more fair rates. And he did that. He made some little bets to see if that would work, and it did, and it ultimately grew into, you know, this institution, the Grameen Bank, which is now, you know, kind of a world-leading institution on micro-lending. And so, but at the end of the day, he had to make sure he was solving the right problems by getting what he calls the worm's eye view. He had to really, really understand the underlying source of problem before he could come up with a solution. We just don't ever learn to think that way. We don't ever learn to think like anthropologists when we're in management training. And ultimately, that's how the great entrepreneurs work. And so that's the point of that chapter, is that problems are really the new solutions for this world we're living in.
And so is the philosophy of Little Bets really to have more than an open mind, but it's to look at something and say, and to admit, you know, I really don't know what the solution is, because I'm not even sure what the problem is, and
right.
and to really approach things with just this kind of a blank slate and say, well, because I don't know, I'm going to try this and we're going to see what happens. Is that
yeah, you can have a hypothesis about what the problem is. Sometimes people will, you know, when Gmail was started, Google, the person who started had a problem that existed for him, Paul Buchenheit. He wanted to be able to have email that suited his needs, and he didn't feel like there was a solution out there that did, so he created something that could, in Gmail. Now, a lot of times that's how people start working on ideas. They have a problem, and they start to work. But a lot of times, you know, when we've got organizations where we're serving customers, we can become very disconnected from the needs of those customers if we're working in an office, you know, if we're working in a cubicle. And so, you know, as Steve Blank, who's a thought leader here on the West Coast in Silicon Valley, says, you know, everything, opinions exist in the office. The facts exist out in the world. And so you need to go out in the world to get the facts, to understand what the problems are. And I think, you know, there's just a subtle shift that a lot of people need to go through to make sure that they're out, you know, really foraging in the world for new problems, rather than just thinking that they have the answers in their own head or in their own office without actually being out in the world.
Maybe we could look at a real world example, one that something that I just did, and you can tell me how I could have done it, maybe with this Little Bet approach more effectively.
All right, I'll give it a try.
So the website, Richer Life, it's a community of people who really want to live a better, fuller, richer life. And I do interviews, and I write a lot of you know, columns and things like that. And then a few months ago I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to have a daily email where there's some sort of, I call it Richer Life tip. And I thought, well, because I it would be hard for me to come up with a tip every single day. So I went out into the community and got a bunch of tips from other people. And so it's taken a lot of time to really get all of these tips, to format them, to put them up, to schedule them, and whatnot. I have no idea, zero idea,
yeah,
if people even want these tips. But I've already committed a lot of time and a lot of energy into doing it.
Right.
Was that a mistake? Could I have done it differently?
Well, you know, time will tell, I guess, whether it works or not. But I mean, yeah, the approach of Little Bets would be to say, okay, let's try this with 10 people and come up with, like, literally just 10 rough ideas for a daily email that you bounce off of these 10 people. And a lot of times in a community like yours, you'll know the people who tend to be the most active users of ideas, the people who may email you the most or what have you. And they'll oftentimes be very willing to be kind of pilots for your ideas. And this is exactly how Chris Rock might work. He'll look at the users in the audience who are the comedy diehards who really know kind of where the good ideas are, and he'll bounce his ideas off those people first because he knows that they're the ones who are the most experienced, they've got the most insight, they're the early adopters of comedy, and he can learn a lot from them. And there's a whole bunch of research that backs up the wisdom of looking at these early adopters early and trying to work actually with them to develop ideas at the early stage. So you could do it that way and potentially save a lot of time. You know, that's one of the things I did working on this book, is I went to other authors and people in publishing who see a lot of ideas to make sure I was going down the right path early, especially with things like the title and with the overall book approach, to make sure I wasn't wasting my time before actually committing to writing a book, which, you know, takes an enormous amount of effort. So that would be the suggestion I have. Look at some of the early users you have and try just some really rough prototypes, really rough draft ideas off them first to see if it's of interest to them, and then you can see whether you're solving an interesting problem or not.
And so with Little Bets, are they often similar to maybe focus groups? Not in the traditional sense of a focus group, but like you said, you ask some other authors, the publishers.
Yeah.
I could go to my members and say, what do you think of this? I mean, is that kind of what a little bit is, where you're just sort of pinging people and saying, what do you think of this?
Well, one of the really important differences between what I think of as a focus group and making little bets is that you're actually taking tangible things to people. You're taking tangible prototypes. You're taking tangible ideas to people that you're basically just bouncing off of them. You're saying, hey, look at this, feel it, touch it, take a look at it, you know, really absorb it. What do you think? As opposed to sitting in a room and having a bunch of, and sitting around and talking about ideas in the abstract. There's an emphasis on using something that's very tangible that you're getting reaction from. And through that process, you tend to get much more rich feedback and insight. This is what Procter & Gamble is trying to do a lot more of. They're trying to, instead of come up with perfect ideas, take ideas that have just duct tape and, you know, cardboard to their end users to see if they're going down the right path early. And that's really, you know, that's a really different approach than traditional market research, I think, where you're doing a lot of survey work.
And so if someone would wanted to write a novel, let's say they've had this great idea for a novel for a long time, and they're at the point where they're ready to start, what would you suggest to them as far as making little bets to see if
that's a great question. Well, it comes down to time and resources, and in the case of writing a book, you get paid up front with an advance before you write a book. And so you want to make sure that somebody's interested enough in the core idea of a novel, I think, to pay you and validate you're going down the right path. And that's how I assume it would work with writing a novel. I don't know exactly how novelists get compensated, to be honest. But I mean, if you think about a novel, you have an aspiration. It's much like starting a company. You have an aspiration for what you want to do. You have a vision. And that's the core. It's the kernel of an idea. It's not the finished idea, because you can't possibly solve all that complexity up front, all the plot twists of a novel, just like you can't understand all the plot twists that it's going to take to form a company up front. But then you actually go out in the world and you start doing it. And as you make progress, you see if you're going down the right path. With novelists, it's much different than being an entrepreneur, because entrepreneurs can learn very quickly whether they're solving interesting problems because they're getting paid or not. And so with a novelist, you know, it's maybe akin to, you know, starting a business where you're trying to conceptualize a lot of it up front. And I would just say to be able to bounce that off of as many, you know, trusted people as possible who can give you honest feedback would be really important before going too far down that path, unless you just want to write a novel for the sake of writing a novel, and some people do want to do that.
No, that's definitely true. And, yeah, the reason I brought up the novel as opposed to a nonfiction book like I've written or you've written is that with a nonfiction book, there's this sort of this core idea that you can bounce off people and say, well, you know, what do you think of this particular topic? With a novel, with fiction, it's really hard to describe what it is and to have that, you know, quote-unquote focus group around something that's a little bit more intangible.
Right.
And so let's say, and again, I know I'm asking a lot of specific questions, but I think to really help people understand this concept of little bet is to really kind of see it in action.
Absolutely.
And so let's say a friend of mine wants to start an online company with big ideas, et cetera. Would a little bet be maybe putting up a blog first and writing about the topic and sort of see where that goes?
Absolutely. I think that's a great example. And, you know, one of the big audiences for this book has been people who want to create something and be entrepreneurial. And we're living in a world where you can do that very inexpensively because, as you say, you can start with a blog post or just a kind of a crappy idea at first that may not go anywhere, but the cost is relatively low because you can get back-end services very, very inexpensively these days. You don't need to go out and buy a new server. You can get that through the cloud at Amazon or these other companies. And so you have very low costs associated with putting up an idea, whether it's a blog or just a preliminary website. And then through that process, you can put it in front of, you get your idea out to people who can help you understand quickly if you're solving the right problems or not, through some people call it the minimum viable product, and then proceed down the path farther. Now, a lot of people have started with blogs that have turned into books, that have turned into companies. it's kind of a common approach these days, but the point is they're actually doing something. And that's tangible, and that leads to the next thing. And they look for what I call in the book small wins. And so, for example, you know, Pixar is now a great film company, but it started off as a hardware company. And they got into films by making short films that were started at 1 minute long. And this is happening at a time when they were, you know, making hardware that was really unrelated to making films. It was just hardware that was selling for $120,000 a machine. And they made these short films to kind of show the value of the hardware. But really, you know, as they made each film, and they made one every year, you know, they got progressively longer. They got much better at telling stories. They got much better at the software. They got much better at the technology side of digital animation, to the point where people started to take notice, and they eventually won an Academy Award for one of their films. It was called Tin Toy, which was really kind of a short version of what became Toy Story. So they built progressively larger credibility. They built progressively larger means towards that aspiration. I mean, they always had that vision that they wanted to make films, but they had to do it in these very small wins until they were ready to be able to make the leap to something much larger. So I think that's a lot of times how we have to work as entrepreneurs. We start small, do lots of iteration, test to make sure we're solving interesting problems, and then get onto a vein that's interesting, and then build from there and really go big once you know that you've got something really interesting on your hands. But you have to be out there in the world doing stuff, I think, to do that, because it's just very, 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 very rare that we'll have this big instantaneous idea and it will become a great company. I still haven't found an example of anybody who can give me a company that started off as one brilliant idea and just became a great company. It just doesn't happen. It's a myth.
I like your approach and recommendation to be out there and to be doing something. I have spoken to SAG members many, many times, and these are not the A-list SAG members. These are the working actors, or the want to be working actors. And what they usually say is, oh, you know, I really want my big break. I really want to be cast in that particular movie, and I really need to be discovered. And my whole approach to them is, you've got to go out there and you've got to create your own stuff. You got to create your own content. You have to be out there, because you never know what it is you're going to create, who you're going to run into. And it's almost this idea of these little bets. You're not waiting to be discovered on a corner. That you're out there engaging in the world and engaging in the market.
Well put, Robert. I really like the way you're framing it. You say it very well.
Thank you. And so you had a phrase a few minutes ago. It was the minimum viable product.
Yeah.
So does that mean a minimum viable product is, this is the absolute least we can put out into the marketplace in order for us to get some useful feedback?
Yeah, exactly. And this has become a catchphrase in Silicon Valley these days. The minimum viable product is just something that is enough that we're not embarrassing ourselves, basically, too much. Although Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, says if you're not embarrassed by your first product, then you've waited too long.
I like that. That is really great.
Yeah, so you really need to put things out as quickly as you're able to present it, you know, kind of without being terrible. The minimum viable product, just so it's viable enough for people to use and to be able to get feedback on, so that you can learn as you go. And the point of a minimum viable product is that you're not perfecting your ideas too much. You're not polishing them too much, because by the time you have, somebody else will have done the idea, or, you know, it won't even be solving the right problems. And so just why waste that time when you can get that feedback instantly?
You know, I'm actually very angry with you, Peter. I'm angry because I wish you would have written this book a couple of years ago, because I've got this web project that we've been working on for too damn long, and because it's not perfect yet.
Right. Well, you know, it's the way we're conditioned to think. You know, our educational and work systems are really focused on this perfectionism and on reducing errors and preventing errors. So it requires just a different approach and a different way of thinking. And these aren't my ideas. These are how people work and think, whether they're doing counterinsurgency in the military where they can't perfect their ideas. They won't survive in the world if they do. They just need to be constantly doing things and iterating and learning as they go. Or entrepreneurs or people who are doing, you know, filmmaking at Pixar. They all use the same basic approach, and it's just that the tragedy is that we don't ever get taught this in school. We have to learn on our own. They have to learn on their own. And my hope with this book is that people can read it and come away with some insight that is not the solution to, you know, all their problems, but it's just that it provides a lot of insight and raises questions that helps them to think a little bit differently as they're going about their jobs and their lives. And that's really why I wrote the book.
And the book definitely does that. I don't think I've mentioned this already, but I love the book. I thought it was absolutely fantastic, well written. The intro and talking about Chris Rock was really, really surprising to me because huge fan of Chris Rock, love his stand-up, his HBO specials. I'm laughing from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But you talk about that he goes into these little tiny clubs and he tries this material, and you write that a lot of times there's dead silence, that nobody is laughing. And I can't believe that he would put himself out there. But that's what it takes, I guess.
Right, he's bombing, and it happens night after night after night. And he won't let anybody record it in the audience so that people see this side of Chris Rock, because that obviously is not the Chris Rock that we all know and love on HBO, as you say. But yeah, he has to do this, and this is just the way all stand-up comedians work. Jerry Seinfeld is the same way. There's a great documentary called The Comedian, if you haven't seen it, that shows how Seinfeld has to bomb, even though he's already made the Seinfeld the show, one of the most successful shows ever. You know, he has to go up there and just be bad until he gets good. And at Pixar, they call their creative process going from suck to non-suck. And that's how it works for comedians. And it's how it works for I think, again, we interviewed over 200 creators. That's how it works for creators. And yet we expect to be perfect at first because of how we're educated. And that just needs to change.
I think I'm going to get a T-shirt made. Going from suck to non-suck. I mean, that's just such a great way of approaching things. And maybe it's just me. I don't know. Maybe it's just me on this track, but I don't think so because your book has done so well. That I think, like you said, we're conditioned to think that things have to be perfect, that they have to be completed, that we have to know all of the answers on day one.
Right.
Which clearly is not the case. Is there a particular process that one can go through? I don't know, some sort of a mental flow chart where before they engage in something new that they can really start to think about, all right, how can I approach this strategically with this little bet mindset?
Yeah, I mean, there are processes out there, and there's a set of methods described in the book that you can take. It doesn't happen in chronological order necessarily. When you're in a creative process, it doesn't happen step A, step B, step C. It's really more about doing things like going out and really engaging in the world, looking at your users, really trying to understand their needs. And there are techniques you can use to learn more about their needs and problems that I write about in the book. And then doing a lot of experimentation and little bets, and then constantly framing and reframing problems, making sure you're defining the right problems, and then being able to step back and do the type of improvisation to come up with new possibilities, like Chris Rock does by writing lots of ideas down on paper, by riffing with a small audience, and then doing constant testing and rigorously repeating that process over and over again until you've tested and retested and rigorously come up with something that, through, you know, your data and analysis shows is working. So it's a combination of thinking, you know, very creatively and then doing a lot of an analysis to make sure you're solving the right problems.
Is there a particular warning sign that you should be aware of, that when you're going down a particular path, some sort of red flag where you realize, uh-oh, I've not made some little bets here. My bets are way too big. Are there some things that people can sort of look out for?
Well, that happens to a lot of companies. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems that affects big companies, is they get to a point where they realize they need larger and larger chunks of revenue, but they haven't been inventing for a long time, and they haven't been making little bets for a long time. They've been focused on just operating their core business. And so this happened to Hewlett Packard. And what they did is they went out and they said, well, we've got to get, you know, we've got to get large chunks of revenue, a couple hundred million dollars in revenue here, a couple hundred million dollars in revenue there. And the way they did that is by trying to come up with products in areas that were big markets, billion-dollar opportunity markets, and then putting the HP label on things like flat-screen TVs and home monitoring equipment and whatnot. And what they found in taking that approach and having to make these big bets is that all the initiatives failed. HP lost hundreds of millions of dollars on these initiatives because they weren't solving the right problems. They weren't really aware of the right customer dynamics. They weren't really close to the end user needs. And so, you know, big bets can work. I'm not saying big bets don't work just out of the gate, but it's this process of discovery, I think, that allows companies to be, say, you know, using 10 to 15% of their time to be making sure they're constantly learning. And this is what Procter & Gamble is now trying to do. It's what HP tries to do. It's what all these big companies try to be able to do better, but oftentimes they get so large that they have to go make acquisitions and do mergers and whatnot. And that's a sign that I think a company's on the verge of decline or failure. And I say that based on looking at the research from Clayton Christensen and Jim Collins. So happens all the time. Companies make these huge big bets and you know, haven't made a lot of little bets. And then the sign that they need to do that is that they have to go out and buy. They have to buy companies. They have to go out and make big bets on, you know, I'm trying to think of it at the individual level too. It's like you realize you don't like your job, but you feel like, well, okay, I got to go get a new job, but you haven't been out there planting seeds with building your network or, you know, looking at other companies where you've got really good leads in to make sure that process goes more smoothly than just having to jump to another company immediately and not even sure if it's going to be the right fit for you or not.
And would you say that little bets are synonymous with little money?
Yeah, I mean, it's affordable. You know, it's defined as what's affordable for you. So whatever is achievable and affordable for you is a little bet. Now, some people think of a little bet as, you know, if it's a company thinking of a little bet and it's General Motors, then maybe that's a several hundred million dollar initiative. Whereas if it's a person, maybe a little bet is just, well, I can afford to go to lunch with this person today. That's achievable. And that's a little bet that I'm going to make. You know, I have the time to go to lunch with this person. So it's time, resources, and it doesn't need to be little money. It just needs to be something that's affordable.
And for the title, Little Bets, did you have that on day one, or was this something that through some sort of a process you came up with?
No, so yeah, to get the level of detail, you know, as I said, I was out speaking with people who I trusted with these very rough, in my case, they were just, I had a few PowerPoint slides that had some visuals of where I was thinking of going. And Ned Barnhill, former HP executive, who mentioned to me that he'd made too many big bets and hadn't made enough little bets. He said that he learned through his experience at HP that they needed to make more little bets. And they went out and lost all these millions on these big bets. And so literally just took that phrase from that discussion, wrote it down, scribbled it down on my sheet of paper, and then I put it into a 3-page overview that I had of the idea for the book that I was bouncing off of other authors and literary agents. And, you know, I had it in the subtitle of that 3-pager I had. The title was something like Experimental Innovation, How Little Bets Lead to Big Ideas. And really, I was having, you know, my first conversation with a literary agent was very painful. I mean, it was like Chris Rock bombing in a club.
You were sucking, right?
It was awful. It was so painful. And she had nothing nice to say except that she liked the term little bets in the subtitle. And so then, based on that insight and based on, you know, talking with some other authors who are best-selling authors who know quite a bit about the book business, they all said the same thing, which is like, we really like this concept. We really like this term and phrase of little bets because it's really core to what you're describing and it's just a catchy phrase, yada, yada, yada. And so I moved that into the title. And after I did that, everybody wanted to work on the book. It was like the seas parted. It was, Every literary agent wanted to work on the book. Every publisher was really interested in the book. And the title is such an important thing to get right, as you know, for a book in the early days. And so that's how it came about. It just literally through this same process as described in the book.
That is a great, great personal story. I'm wondering when you wrote down Little Bets, and then when you were talking to other authors that you respected, did you ask them specifically, hey, what do you think about Little Bets? Or did it... did you go into it thinking, I'm really going to try to find out what they think of this title? Or was it kind of by accident?
Oh, no, it was literally just by showing them this three-pager, like literally putting the three-page overview in front of them and having them react to it and then having a discussion with them. And they would all kind of point to the same thing. They would all point to this phrase, Little Bets, and they would say the same thing. I wasn't telling them that I thought that it was a good idea. I wasn't trying to bias them.
Interesting.
I mean, a lot of these techniques and methods, I should say, come from the world of design thinking, which is, we didn't talk about kind of where the book came about, but, there's this whole world of design thinking, which Steve Jobs models at Apple, and, which is this approach to creating ideas, to building ideas from the bottom up, and one of the methods is that you just put things in front of people without biasing them. And see how they react. And so that's basically, I've been connected, affiliated with the Stanford Design School for some time. That was one of the reasons to write this book. And that's what you do. You put it in front of people and you see how they react. And then it's not market research where you're giving them some lead, leading into some answer that you're hoping they'll come up with.
Right, which I'm sure happens all the time.
Right, in market research.
In traditional market research. All right. Well, this is fantastic. I mean, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I really, really well written, and such a powerful message that can save people years of their life and lots of their money if they. I'm saying if they just start to make little bets, but I'm really talking about myself here as well, because I am guilty of this more than anybody.
Well, same experience, Robert. If it makes you feel any better, I used to be the same way, and it's changed my whole approach as well.
Yeah. No, this is great. I'm wondering, how can people learn more about you and the book? Where should they go?
Well, my website has an introduction, free introduction, and a bunch of resources, and it's just www.petersims.com, and then the book is available on Amazon and all booksellers. I mean, it's basically everywhere.
It really is everywhere, and it should be everywhere. It's a fantastic book, and I know you've had a lot of success with it, and I hope you continue to have lots of success with it.
Hey, it's great speaking with you, Robert. Great questions, and keep making those bets. You're going down. I can tell it's going to be really interesting to see how your site evolves over time.
It's going to be painful only because this is not the approach I've always taken, but in the long run it's going to be a whole lot better.
Go from suck to non-suck, just like everyone.
This is how it works. That's going to be another T-shirt. I like that
as well. For Chris Rock or Pixar filmmakers, so how can you do otherwise?
Right. No, if you follow in their footsteps, it's hard to go wrong. So thank you so much for your time, Peter. This, again, has been fantastic. Your website is petersims.com. It's petersims.com. I would encourage everyone to go out and get Little Bets. It will save you lots of time and money.